This shiur is dedicated to Rachaleah ben Reb Chaim Tzvi. Okay, we're going to be talking about Pesach. So the first thing that we have to really take in is the light of Pesach already begins to descend to the world immediately after Purim, the 30 days before the holiday, 30 days in which there's progressively more light. What's the light of Pesach? The light of Pesach is the light of Emunah and Geulah. So let's define our terms. Emunah, as we said many times in these shiurim, is the awareness that everything comes from Hashem, everything is good, and everything requires tikkun, everything requires a response. What's Geulah? Geulah is returning to a state where you're yourself. It's returning to self. So who's the self, you could ask? You know, listen to how we talk. My foot hurts. Now that seems to mean that I'm not my body. But we also say, my soul yearns. So that sounds like I'm not my soul. We say, neshama shenatata bi, the soul that you gave me, so who's me? So the idea is, of course, that we have a very fragmented sense of identity. So if we want to say that the truest self is the most enduring self, the self that lasts forever, that self is the spark of godliness within us that's often concealed by many, many, many layers of self, also of self. So Geula means being able to peel away all of the externals and coming to know oneself. So this could be on an individual basis, Geula Saprat. This could also be on a collective level, Geula Saklal, where the Jewish people collectively come to a state of living up to and recognizing who they are and who they could be. So the light of Pesach is the light of Emunah and Geula, which means that everything that happens to us on the way to Geula is from Hashem, for Tikkun, is good, and that it leads somewhere. And that somewhere is actualization of our potential as a people. So before we begin our actual shiur, I'm going to quote one of the great Magidim of Yerushalayim, Rav Tzvi Meyer Zilberberg, who spoke about these days, the days before Pesach. And what he said is that there are several things we have to remember in these days. So here's the first one, we're going to be four. The first thing to remember is the difference between Iker and Tefel, the difference between that which is essential and that which is subservient to that which is essential. What's the main thing and what isn't? Okay, the main thing is Emunah. The main thing is living each day with Emunah. So what that means concretely is as we go through the process of removing chametz from our homes, we have to have Emunah. So what does that mean concretely? How do you have Emunah as you remove chametz? So what that means is take ego out of the process, completely out of the process. So we do that by, first of all, getting rid of chametz. It's very nice to have spring cleaning take place simultaneously. It gives a sense of renewal and refreshment, but it's not essential. So you have to have a sense of ikar and tefel. The important thing is to get rid of the chametz, which, if you had to, could be done in half a day. But everything else is nice, and it's good, and it's productive, but it's not ikar. So if a person reaches a point where because they're doing things that are extraneous and ultimately unnecessary, they lose their Emunah, then it's not worth it. Now how do you know? Nobody would say they lost their Emunah. So I have to tell you what the main symptom of losing Emunah is. The main symptom of losing Emunah is anger. Anger means the voice of anger, no matter what the cause of anger is, it's always the same voice. This is not how it should be. It should be the way I want it to be. Now, believe me, before Pesach, there's going to be plenty of reason to say that. Deliveries that don't come or don't come on time, people who commit themselves to doing things and don't do it, things that are done sloppily. The Nisayon of Pesach is to say, I have Emunah. This is exactly as it's supposed to be, even if it's not the way I want it to be. Another thing to consider is that over the years, different communities have different levels of chumrah. that's part of Pesach, and it's good, and it's holy, and it shows the desire to do Hashem's will. But no amount of chumrah could ever fix what's ruined through anger. So oftentimes, I don't know how many of you are married, if any of you are married, those of you who are married, by the nature of things, didn't grow up in homes that are identical to your husband's homes. You may be used to one set of standards, he may be used to another set of standards. It's not worth it, on any level, to create misunderstandings over this. If he wants more and you're used to less, so do a little more. It's okay. It's holy. If he's used to less and you're used to more, so let go of some of it. This is an important thing to say because it's very rare for Pesach to pass by without people having their moments, and it could be avoided. I have to tell you a story. One of the great Rebbes, the Rav Shitzer Rav, actually had this happen. To him, the preparations for Pesach all centered around the matzah. He had holy kavanot. He understood what matzot are beyond the body of the matzot. So there's a great deal of spiritual preparation, besides all of the physical preparation. The matzah bakery that looked like it was wrapped in paper, the whole thing. Okay, as things happened, he did his matzah for the Seder the day before Pesach. There were many other boxes of matzah in the house that were meant to be given out to unfortunate people who didn't have their Pesach supplies. So he put his matzahs on the table. The other matzahs were on boxes in other areas. Somehow, all of the boxes of matzahs ended up on the table, and his matzahs were given away. So the Rebbetzin was the first to realize what happened, and she told the Shamash, don't tell him, because there's nothing we could do about it. We don't know who we gave it to. There were hundreds of people who walked through the store in the last 2 days. We don't know their names, we don't know their addresses. The holiday's coming in 25 minutes. Don't tell him. Okay, so the Shamash saw that there really was no other way, so he didn't tell him. So the Rebbe's Seder was conducted over not the matzahs that he had prayed over and used Kabbalistic Havanot for, but matzot that were just matzot, kosher, but matzot. And years passed, close to 20 years. Close to 20 years. One day, the Rebbe is in the kitchen, and she couldn't help but overhear a couple who had come to the Rebbe to discuss their own personal relationships, their shalom bayit. And the husband was going on and said, I can't swallow anymore. I can't swallow anymore. How much could a person let go of? I can't let go of another thing. I can't bear it. The Rebbe said, you could bear it. You could let go of anything. The husband said, I can't make... It's not within my capacity. So the Rebbe said, I want to tell you something. And he told the whole story. He spoke about how he'd been preparing spiritually for Pesach for a month, how the preparation centered around the matzot, how his matzot were given away and he ate ordinary matzot. The Rebbetzin never knew that he knew. No one told him. He must have recognized them in some way. He didn't say a word. He acted as though nothing happened. And he didn't... There was no, I told you so. There was nothing. For 20 years. That's what we have to bring ourselves to. The next thing. Realistically, in order to bring ourselves to that place, we have to not open ourselves up to what's called katnas demochen, being small-minded. The way you do this is by seeing that you're not hungry and you're not tired. So it means an inherent part of Pesach preparations has to be planning your days so that you're not forcing yourselves to be crazy. Third thing. The third thing is you have to make spiritual preparations. So it means as you're doing it, you have to continually remind yourself what you're doing and for who. That this is ultimately removing chametz because Hashem, on his side, said that this time of the year is a time when this is both necessary and possible. So to understand this last idea, we have to talk about what chametz is. So I'm sure most of you have heard the idea of this, that chametz, of course, is a symbol of the Yetzirah in general, and arrogance specifically. So let's understand these two things. The Yetzirah is called the yeast that's in the bread. Yeast is a bacteria. The reason why it makes bread rise is because the bread, so to speak, defends itself against the Yetzer Hara. This is called oxidization. Similarly, the Yetzer Hara there is as a catalyst to force us to be who we wouldn't be had we not met temptation and faced it and dealt with it. Okay, now the side effect is being blown up as having an overdeveloped sense of one's own uniqueness and importance. So the Gras says that gaiva leads to everything else. As soon as a person, instead of aiming their she'ifot, their yearnings towards Hashem, their yearnings are towards being higher than others, more than others, the best. As long as there's comparison there, one ends up an idolater with the idol being oneself. So we know that Avraham Avinu served matzahs to his guests, and not only did he, but Lot, who was on a much, much lower level, an incomparably lower level, served matzah to the guests who came to him in Sodom. Now, obviously, neither Avraham nor Lot were keeping Pesach to commemorate the events that took place at the Exodus. The Exodus didn't happen. So why were they eating matzah? So what Avraham understood was that in the spring, when everything begins to blossom anew, and we see Hashem's creativity, just seeing Hashem's greatness should humble us. So this humility isn't the consequence of loss of self-esteem. It's the consequence of seeing Hashem's greatness and glory. So he said, at a moment like this, we have to be absolutely humble. So matzah, flat bread, is a symbol of humility. So we have to remember this, that we're celebrating Hashem who liberated us and getting rid of the arrogance. So there can't be, none of it. None of the, I'm frommer than you because we do this while you only do that. None of it. The last thing is, in order to be spiritually prepared, there are two things you absolutely have to do. One is, you absolutely have to review the halachot. Even if you've been keeping Pesach your entire life, you have to review the halachot. You have to review the halachot. So let's say your life is not such that you're going to learn Shulchan Aruch with all of the Nosei Kelim. At least review it in one of the books that are more or less making Pesach for you and me, whatever it is. You have to review the halachot. The next thing is, today when there are so many CDs and tapes, you have to listen to the Ruchnius of Pesach, because otherwise you'll forget it and it'll leave you. So that's about the preparation, and with that we're going to go into the Haggadah. We're going to have two classes on Pesach. Today we're going to do the beginning of the Haggadah as far as we get, and next time, I know this will shock you, the rest of the Haggadah as far as we get. So with that, the first thing that we begin with when doing the Haggadah are the Simanim. Okay, so we have to understand what these Simanim are about. They're about order. The entire evening is called the Seder, which means order. To us, order has to do with convenience or aesthetics. This is Hashem's order and how He moves us from a state of Galus to a state of Geula. So let's begin with this. The first step in making this movement is Kadesh. So Kadesh, of course, means making Kiddush. So Alshach says the first step of moving from Galus, which is not knowing yourself, not knowing the Holy Spark, is learning to sanctify yourself with that which is permitted. So all Kiddush on all holidays and Shabbos has to do with uplifting. We use wine as a vehicle because wine is a symbol of the secret self. The word Yayin is Sod. So we begin by saying the secret self, the self that's less accessible and available, has to be the predominant voice if we want redemption. Next, Orchatz. We wash our hands. Now, if this was our order, which is convenience and efficiency, we would say, oh, we should eat the karpas during the meal, and then we wouldn't have to wash our hands for it. We would wash only once, not twice. So the reason why we wash separately is because both of these simanim have integral purpose. So Orchatz. Okay, it says, Mi yale baharka Hashem, mi, who's going to go up to Hashem's mountain? And then you have a list of traits. One of them is Naki kapayim uvar levav, one who has clean hands and a pure heart. What does it mean to have clean hands? So on a simple level, what that means is really looking and seeing whether your belief in Hashem Hashgacha is so great that nothing that someone else's ever ends up in your hands without their implicit or explicit permission. The reason why this is so important is that you either believe that what you need is what you have, or you don't. And if you don't, you're going to find compromise as part of your life. Okay, so Naki Kapai means you're absolutely sure. On a deeper level than that, the function of the hand is fine motor action. Being precise, you could pick up a needle with your fingers. So the idea there is that serving Hashem with pure hands, with clean hands, also means learning the art of precision. In this coming week's parsha here in Israel, the very end of the parsha talks about this, that the Torah forbids our eating insects. Rashi says something interesting. You have to know what they are. So there are different sorts of insects, and the number of Yisurim will go from 4 to 8, but these are all Yisurim Midoraisa. They're serious, so that means you have to know how to be precise. You can't be approximate. You can't mean well. That's not good enough. You have to do well. That's Nikayon Kapayim. Next, Karpas. So Karpas is eating a vegetable. Why are we eating a vegetable in the middle of the Seder? For what? And the classical answer is so the children will ask. Now, those of you who were children, I'm sure some of you were never children, you just came into the world fully developed, like Topsy in Uncle Tom's Cabin. But those of you who are children may recall that it's not particularly satisfying. Yes, if your parents, why do we do this? And they say, just to keep you asking. Okay, that's not, it's not all that satisfying. So there's got to be more than that. So different approaches, here's one of them. Of the different foods that we eat, vegetables are very simple. They're there. You don't have to make them, you don't have to make them come onto the scene. You can eat a stick of celery or a carrot. Even vegetables that need to be cooked require very little when you compare them to bread or to meat. So hear this Gemara. When Adam was expelled from the Garden of Eden, he was in terrible despair. He did the worst thing any human could or ever will do. He brought death into the world. He brought tragedy and exile and everything that comes with it. He exiled Hashem from the world he created. So there were consequences, and every consequence hit him with terrible force. So one of them was the necessity to eat ordinary food, not the spiritually rarefied food of Gan Eden, but ordinary food. So he said to God, how am I going to live? And he said, you'll plant, and it'll grow. And he repeated the curses that food, that the process was given. He said, does that mean that me and my animal will be eating in the same way? He'll be eating straw, and I'll be eating straw. And God said, no, there's a difference. So he said, what? So he said, you'll uplift the food by baking a blessing upon it. So, food is in a category called klipat noga, where whether it's holy or not depends on you. It can conceal Hashem or reveal Hashem. It's up to you. It's see-through klipa, see-through shell or peel. When you say a bracha on kosher food, you uplift yourself and you uplift the food. How do you do that? You uplift yourself by virtue of the blessing that you say and the consciousness that it develops. You uplift the food by, at this point, defining something that was ordinary as holy through the bracha. So the idea is no matter who you are and where you are and how many mistakes you've made in your life and how distant you feel from Hashem and how ordinary you feel and how remote these ideas seem from your day-to-day life, okay, you could uplift karpas. You touch it with clean hands, you say a blessing on it, and you have to dip it. So the idea of dipping in salt water also, this is to commemorate the tears. Our suffering also sanctifies us. So this is an important siman. Next is yachatz. In order to talk about yachatz, we have to first talk about matzah. In order to talk about matzah, we have to talk first about its substance, and then the spiritual form that it takes. So the substance of matzah is flour and water. Nothing could be simpler in terms of food than mixing flour and water. So matzah, as we said, is a sign of simplicity, a sign of humility. It's meant to recall the simplicity of the garments that the Kohen Gadol wore when he entered the Holy of Holies. So the substance of simplicity, of spirit and body, of water and flour, are what we take in. Okay, the matzot are the three matzot upon which we make the Seder, parallel the three avot, meaning each one of them took his mind, because the matzot, as we'll explain momentarily, also reflects intellectual power. It's a direct opposite parallel to karpas. Each one of the avot took his mind and addressed Hashem in a unique way. What does matzah have to do with the mind? So as simple as matzah is, no animal will ever bake matzah. In order to bake matzah, you have to have flour. To turn flour into anything requires at least 11 steps. And you need exactitude, and you need fire making. So because of this, bread and matzah is a form of bread, okay, is a symbol of the mind. Concerning this, it says that a child begins to develop intellectually from the time they can eat flour and bread. It shows that their mind is developing to the form that a human mind could be. Now, no two people's minds are exactly the same. Our interior lives are at least as unique as our exterior reality. So when you're talking about the minds of the avot, realize each one of them perceived reality differently because they were different. Avram's perception was that the world is a place that God created and blessed. He would bring Hashem into the world and expand the world and show how everything is an extension of Hashem's chesed. So the first matzah, the first way of thinking, is Avraham. The Kohanim are a part of the Jewish people in Avraham's merit. It says in Tehillim concerning Avraham, Ata Kohen La'olam, you're the eternal Kohen. You're the one who brings blessing into everything. Yitzchak's way of thinking was different. Yitzchak was a man of discipline, of self-discipline, of rules, of borders that one doesn't cross. Why? Because he was aware of evil. He said, I'm not going to let the good that Avraham discovered be covered by evil. I'm going to shed the peels. I'll say no. The Levim entered Am Yisrael's body or family in the merit of Yitzchak. Levi produced Moshe. Moshe was the ultimate lawgiver. Yaakov saw the world still differently. He saw the whole picture. He saw that you could say yes and no simultaneously. You could sanctify food, for instance, but you have to say no to non-kosher food and no to gluttonous behavior. You have to say yes and no at the very same moment. So what he discovered was that you could live a life of truth and find Hashem in any person, situation, object, experience. So this is why in Birkat HaMazon we say Kedoshenu Kedosh Yaakov, not Kedosh Avraham. His name was later changed to Yisrael, which means Hashem will prevail. So something of Yaakov is in every Jew. Jews could uplift physicality, could say no and yes at the same moment, and Hashem will prevail within each one of us. So the third matzah is Yisrael. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, three ways of thinking that are unique and distinct and make us a people. Yachatz requires that we take the middle matzah and break it into uneven pieces. What's that about? So there are different reasons why we have to break this. Let's look at several of them. So remember, this is all taking us to Geula. So the first thing to know is that the key to redemption is a broken heart. What does that mean? It means that the smaller we are, the more humble we are, and the more sensitive we are to the suffering of others, to Golas HaShechina, to Hashem's being expelled from the world by us and our deeds, the more open and real our tefillot are, and the more the tefillot will affect our lives. On a similar but not identical level, one part of the matzah will be used for saying the Haggadah. The other will be hidden. So another part of getting through this life, with all of its rigors, is knowing that This life is part one of the story. There's part two. Part two is Olam Haba. In this world, time passes swiftly, so we can't hold on to the joy of any of our deeds or the connection. In Olam Haba, it's there like a feast before us. So Yemot HaMashiach, both, and Olam Haba are symbolized by the hidden matzah. But this world has importance and significance because we know it's not the end. I want to share this with you. I once met a man, a very interesting man. His name was Lazer Nanas. Some of you who read English Judaica may know the book that he wrote. It was called Subota. He wrote it under a pen name. He used the name Yisrael Netzach. This book was a true story. Subota means Shabbos in Russian. He lived in Russia in the bad old days, and he knew that inevitably he'd be sent to Siberia, and he was. He was there for 20 years. And during that entire time, he was able to keep Shabbos, which is virtually unprecedented. So before he was sent there, he knew that he needed to strengthen himself. He wanted an image to hold on to. So he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe of the time, who was the father-in-law of the one who died, I think, 13 years ago, whatever number of years ago. His name was Rav Yosef Yitzchak. And he said, I want to tell you something. Here's how you could stay strong. Realize nothing can change you unless you empower it to change you. Evil has no power unless you give it power. So he understood it. So he shared this experience. When he was first imprisoned, he knew he would be taken at some point to be interrogated. There was this horrific room, the interrogation chamber. How would you go into an interrogation chamber? I could tell you how I'd go in. I'd go in like this. He knew what that could be. He knew of the terrors that the interrogations could be, beatings and starvation and humiliation and worse. He went in, totally confident, and sat down in the chair like this. So the interrogator said, I didn't tell you to sit. And he said, you're right, I didn't tell you to sit either. And the interrogator, like, never heard anything like that in his life, says, don't you know where you are? And he said, I know where I am, but I want to tell you something. Today I'm on this side of the desk, and you're on that side. For all you know, tomorrow you'll be on this side of the desk, and somebody else will be on that side. And in Russia that was true. So the reason I'm telling you this story is that knowing that there's more than what the world shows you there is, there's more than money, and there's more than kavod, and there's more than pleasure, is what gives this world its value. Next, Magid. The main part of the Haggadah is called Magid. Magid means telling. So the reason why this is the centerpiece of the Haggadah is because who we are is both expressed through and developed by what we say. So the more we talk, the more our abstraction of self becomes defined, the closer we are to Geula when we talk about Geula. So our speech not only expresses us, but affects us. This is why one of the three dinim of Ava Yisrael is to speak well of people. Because when you do, you become a person who could love, because they could see goodness. Similarly, you become a redeemable person by speaking about Geula. Okay, next, we go into the meal part. So we have Rachtza, Motzi, Matzah. Okay, we wash our hands for the matzah. So we spoke about the matzah already, but I want to go back a few steps and talk about the wine. Now at this point, we're already up to the second cup, so I really should have spoken about the wine earlier. What's the wine about? We know what the matzah is about. The matzah is about the avos. Maharal tells us that the wine is about the imahot. And as well as, of course, as we know from Chazal, being about the expressions of redemption. Hotzeti, hitzalti, ga'alti, lakachti. What's this about? So when we look at wine, we're going to notice two very important features. One is, as we said before, wine expresses the secret self. It's the internalized, deeper, secret self. On the other hand, the halacha is when you have food and drink, we always assume the drink is tafel, is less important than food. The food is the mainstay of the meal, and drink accompanies that. Similarly, in Iker and tafel, the imahot accompany the avot. So we have to understand what that means. We don't know a lot about the Imahot compared to the Avot. Have you noticed this? As much as we learn about them, the clarity which we say, Avram was Chesed, and Yitzchak was Din, and Yaakov was Em, we can't say that about the Imahot. When we learn about them, if I were to tell you, Rachel and Leah are Netzach and Hod, it doesn't resonate with the same level of clarity. And for many of you, you wouldn't even know what Netzach and Hod are. So there's a reason for this. The Avot and the Imahot together were one persona. The Imahot were the inner part. What's the inner part? So the two parts of Am Yisrael are Emes and Emunah. Emes is a vessel that contains Emunah. The Avos were Mitzuyan in Emes. Avram and Yitzchak led to Yaakov, the source of all Emes, Titen Emes liYaakov. But Emunah is a different thing. Emunah comes from, in some ways, a higher place, in some ways, a higher place than Emes. Emes is descriptive. Emunah is more than descriptive. In Mitzrayim and throughout history, women were stronger in Emunah and men were stronger in Emes. However, Emunah needs to be in a vessel of Emes. What does that mean? The same way all liquid assumes the shape of its vessel, our need to believe and to have faith as Jews has to be in a true vessel. Otherwise, chas v'shalom, what we come to is emunah tefela, false faith. What does that look like? So, it could take on two faces. One is absolute falsehood. What I want to believe must be true. If I want it, then it must be true. That's called false faith. True faith is what Hashem wants, and that's good. False faith is if I want it, that's how it has to be. So when a person says, if I do this, then surely I'll get the result I want, that's emunah tefela. It's a step away from avodah zarah, a step away from magic and all of the other nonsense. But an offshoot of that is what I would call harmless superstition. If I go to the Kotel for 40 days, then for sure I'll get married. No, that wasn't going to the Kotel. It was saying Shir HaShirim 40 days. No, that was Pirkei Shira 40 days. No, that, okay. I mean, we do everything but say Pirkei de Rebbe Elezer, whatever. All of these things are true. I do these things. I'm not going to say that they're emunah tefela. They're not. But in the scale of importance, a mitzvah is much, much more than any of these. Maisa Shahaya, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was a person who you could trust with anything. So people would give him large sums of tzedakah to distribute. He had a very special tzedakah gabbai, but that's a different story for a different day. So he would make a condition with the people. They would give him, again, large sums of money, thousands of dollars. He would say, as soon as you give me this money, it's only on condition that I could do what I want with it. I don't want you to come back and say, you should have given it here, you should have given it there. If you're giving it to me, it's on my terms. And people would agree. They trusted him. So he had these large sums oftentimes at his disposal. Someone came to him who wanted to reprint a certain important sefer that had gone out of print, that was written by some, I don't remember the relationship, but some ancestor of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And it's an important sefer, but not what anybody would call a vital sefer. And in order to republish it, and that, it required re-editing and tracing manuscripts, it required a lot of work and would cost a lot of money. Someone came to Rav Shlomo Zalman for a contribution towards this goal, which is a worthy goal. And he said, I know you have a lot of tzedakah. Perhaps you'll consider supporting this project. And he said, no. He was willing to give his own money, but not the tzedakah money. And the man said, why not? This is written by your ancestor. Again, I don't remember the relationship. It's connected to you. It's a skula. And you know what he said? He said, there's a widow who doesn't know where her rent's going to come from next month. It's a much bigger skula to give her tzedakah. He wouldn't buy into substituting tefel for ikker. So you could do these things, but they can't be central to your life if you know emes. So the emunah has to be in an honest vessel. So what does this have to do with the four expressions of redemption? The Talmud tells us that there are 10 amounts of speech, and women have 9. And when you tell this to men, they say, are you sure that it's not 9.5? So it's not just that women talk a lot, but women need to express themselves, which is part of emunah. We need to give expression to our inner selves. We're more connected to the physical world, and we need to make sense of it and uplift it and talk about it. So the expressions of ge'ula, being able to talk about ge'ula, is an important aspect of emunah. There are 4 expressions of ge'ula. The first is hotzeiti. Hotzeiti means you took us out. So one aspect of emunah is no matter where you are, you live with the recognition Hashem could take you out of there. You could be in a bad marriage and it could turn good, or you could come out. You could be in a difficult family situation with your parents. You could have a sick child, you could be sick. You could hear terrible things about people who are close to you. You could listen to air raid sirens. No matter where you are in life, and the worst of all would be you could be distant from God, He could take you out. And women know this better than men and could speak about it. The next is hitzalti, you rescued me. So what people tragically often experience is once they're out of wherever they wanted to be out of, the next step is talking about themselves. I once even heard someone describe themselves, are you ready, as a self-made person. How do you like that one? Now, they didn't mean that they actually formed, I would assume they didn't mean, they didn't like create the cells that got together in their mother's womb and caused them to reproduce. But what they meant was materially and spiritually, it's all me. None of it is that. I want to tell you, the more people I've gotten to know, the more I see that everybody's life could be written into a novel. Nobody who's listening to this is where they are today in life except that Hashem rescued them from other possibilities. Next, ga'alti. I took you to being your highest self. It's taking the same idea further. Lakachti. I gave you meaning. I made you mine. So Maharal talks about non-Jews, and he divides them into 3 different categories. So one level are non-Jews who serve idols. So by definition, the word for idolatry in Hebrew is avodah zarah, which literally means foreign practice. That means you're serving something other, not Hashem. So of course, if you're serving other, you're not serving Hashem, and you have no relationship. So a person with no relationship to God is dead, because only God's eternal and the source of eternity. Okay, the next level down from there are non-Jews who don't serve idols. Think of the Bobbsey twins. Think of Lucy, if I love Lucy. Now stop thinking of them, never think of them again. People who live their lives, but God isn't part of it. But they believe, if they were forced to the wall, in meaning and in goodness, and ultimately in God. So those people have relationship. The last is a category that doesn't bear discussing. Heretics, people who, like the communists, who not only don't believe but want to force others into disbelief. These people don't have lakachti. Even the middle group, the people who live good lives, some of them will have a chelik in olam haba, but they can't say Hashem took me and made me His own. They don't have the 4 lashonos of geula. Only we do. So that's the wine, and that takes us back to the meal. Okay, maror. Maror is bitter herbs. Now, there are 2 things that are interesting. The perfect maror on Pesach night is romaine lettuce. It's not all that bitter. It's tasteless. So there's, even though you could have truly, you know, you could have truly bitter herbs, as people do, horseradish, okay, but it doesn't have to be. It's not only horseradish. There's a difference between sadness and bitterness that we've discussed many times in these shiurim. Sadness is, or depression is, where you feel things are uninterpretable and too big and you can't bear them, you escape. To sleep, to drugs, to denial, wherever you escape to. Bitterness is like when I serve my husband's cousins coffee and I put in 2 teaspoons or 3 teaspoons of salt instead of sugar by accident. So the result is I reject it. I don't want it. Can't have it. So the lesson of gullus is rejected. If you don't want gullus, then reject it. Say, I don't want to be in gullus. That means I don't want to be defined by the nations. I don't want their definitions of reality. I don't want their mindset. I want myself. You have to be willing to suffer and let go of a lot before you get there. It's not easy. Next, Korech. Korech is the Hillel sandwich. The idea being that we're eating both the symbol of redemption, matzah, with maror, with the symbol of enslavement. So Maharal explains that that tells us that exile is a part of redemption. You can't know who you are until you're willing to say, I know who I'm not. Ze lo, not this. You have to be able to do both in the same moment. This is the sandwich. Now on to the meal. So the meal, the idea of having this meal, it's still celebrating the Korban Pesach. The idea being that we're, like in the Korban Pesach, where the actual sacrifice was a lamb. The symbol of a lamb is that of being a follower. We have no will of our own. Everything's for Hashem. We sit down to eat this meal, at least this one meal of the year. It should all be l'kavod shemayim. Gosh, I made this incredible matzah kugel or whatever. Tzafun, the afikomen. Okay, the hidden essence of the Seder, the geula that's yet to come. So as you know, the custom is that we involve children in the afikomen. Why children? So one of the big differences between a child and an adult is a child knows that he doesn't know. As adults, we interpret life and interpret our interpretations of life so much that we think we have it sewn up. So there's nothing hidden, there's nothing mysterious. We try to define everything, we try to describe everything. We try to conquer everything with our minds. So as you know, for instance, if a person is diagnosed with grave illness, the doctor won't come out and say, oh, this is terrible, I feel so bad for you, you'll have to have these terrible... No, it's like, well, it looks like this is this, and this is called that, and you know... If you could intellectualize something, you could make it smaller. A child could say, mazeh, they could say, what is it? So children are intimately involved in the afikomen. So the whole custom of the children, entering their moments of extortion, you know... If you get, one of my children once asked me, we were living, all of us were living in one apartment, of course, 14 children, and one of my kids asked for afikomen for her own bedroom. Okay, so you don't have to give into it, by the way, but the idea is that you could, on Pesach night, you should realize we could ask from Hashem whatever we want. What we want most of all is connection, and we could ask for it. Beirech, Halel, Birkat HaMazon, praising Hashem. It all leads to Nirtza. The very end of the Haggadah is Nirtza. The end of the evening is Nirtza. So what Nirtza is about is song. There's a difference between song and speech. So as I just said a moment ago, speech is the handmaiden of the mind. Speech always creates limitations. If I say this is a Haggadah, which it is, I'm simultaneously telling you that it's nothing other than a Haggadah. I'm making it small and defined. I'm making borders around it. The more eloquently a person could speak, the more exact the borders that they're drawing are. So those of you who like literature or poetry, when you read literature, the beauty and art of literature is that they can get a fine edge on reality by making borders that are specific and defined. Song takes you above that. The word mizmor is the same word as the verb lizamer, which means to prune away things, get away all the extraneous stuff. Go to the core. So song, negina, is the voice of emuna, not the voice of emes. Okay, the nations of the world also know this. This is why they include music in their religious services as well, in virtually every society. So there's a premise that every chachma has its own nigun. Parallel to every way of investigating reality intellectually, there's a super-rational aspect that could be expressed through that chachma. So the nigun of the Jews is specific. So a person has to be able to have a nigun, an actual nigun, that they could fall back on to remind them who they are. So the holiness of Negina is what we end the Seder with. Now you'll understand, and this will take us, Yirtzeh Hashem, to our next Limud. This is why there's a custom after the Seder to read Shir HaShirim, the song of all songs, the Nigun of all Nigun. So even though we use words in Shir HaShirim, it's all mashal, none of it is actual. It's meant to take us to this place of super-rational emuna oriented connection, which is ultimately what Geula is all about. So from here, from knowing the Seder, you know, Kaddish, Urchatz, Yah, all of them, from knowing these simanim, we reach Hashem. The number of simanim that there are 15. This is parallel to the Shirei Hamala, the steps to the temple, in the temple that led from one area to another. Hashem's name, Yud-Kei, which takes us from the finite reality of this world. The letter Hey, 2 feet on the floor. Life where you have to decide which oven cleaner is the best one this year. That kind of life. To the life of Yud, the unknowable place of Olam Haba that's within us and within the world. We should be worthy of Geula Shalema and having next Pesach celebrated at the Korban Pesach in the Beis HaMikdash.